Hello, everybody. It's the Pick Six Podcast. This is not Will Brinson. It's Ryan Wilson from sunny upstate New York, where it is actually 70 degrees for the first time literally this calendar year. John Breach is from an underground bunker somewhere, and Sean Wagner McGuff, I feel like, is probably outside the walls of King's Landing, no doubt wondering where it all went wrong. Hey, guys.
Hey, Ryan. Where is Brinson?
That's funny you ask. Before we get to that, let me tell you quickly what we're going to talk about today. First things first, the best remaining free agents in what is a dwindling class post-draft. Sean's favorite off-season topic that isn't Game of Thrones related. The Bears kicking woes, Sean.
Woo!
And then finally, maybe we'll get to a little Game of Thrones action. And what, in my opinion, as an open-minded observer, was the worst episode in Game of Thrones history. But before we get to that, Will Brinson.
I like that you throw that in, because you know I can't respond right now.
I know that hurts me.
Now I'm going to be angry for the entire podcast.
Good. I like angry Sean. But Brinson is actually, he mentioned this on yesterday's podcast, he is at Disney World with his family. And I love that Brinson, who spends 95% of his waking life on Twitter, implored people not to come up to him and bother him if they see him at Disney World. I implore these very same people to go up to Brinson, get a selfie, send it to @PickSixPod or send it to us on Twitter so we can verify it. Don't accost him. Don't assault him. But, you know, you can harass him from afar with cell phone pictures. Leave his wife and kid out of it, but I think he deserves to be harangued as much as possible. Have either of you guys been to Disney?
I have been there once, and I was a young child, which makes me wonder what it would be like to go there as an adult. And I think that leads to my question of, on a scale of 1 to Brinson snaps, takes 3 people hostage after finishing all the beer in his hotel, how do you think his vacation goes?
Sean?
I think it goes well, but I think he spends too much time tweeting about it and looks at his phone too much the entire time.
Well, today is an indication. It's about 2 o'clock on Monday, and Sean and Brinson and I are on a thread. Breach, you're not on the thread because you don't have an iPhone. That's literally the only reason. But he has texted us probably, well, this morning I woke up to 76 texts, so that's not a joke, because he and Sean were tweeting back and forth about the Game of Thrones episode. And I don't read those.
That anymore. Was last night, though, for the record.
Well, starting at midnight or so. And then this morning, Brent was tweeting from the plane to down to Orlando. He's texted since then. He told me yesterday that they're not going to the park on their arrival day, which would be Monday, but they'll be there Tuesday through Friday. So again, I implore people to take selfies to Brinson and send.
Not only, by the way, is Brinson texting us. He's texting us, and before we can reply, he's like doing the reaction to his text and laughing at his own text.
Right. So he's clearly, this is going to go terribly.
And I would like to point out that we are all three of us here recording this podcast, which clearly means we are all strong believers in Bill Belichick's philosophy of no days off. Brinson just out prancing around in Florida on vacation. Man, that guy just doesn't work, goes on vacation. We're all no days off.
Well, he thinks it's Tom Brady. At the Kentucky Derby, wearing the same outfit, but the difference is he doesn't have the production of Tom Brady. He's more like Brian Hoyer, who, by the way, is at work today. He ain't at the Kentucky Derby with Tom Brady. All right, so let's see. Before we get started with the best remaining free agents, John, you wrote this weekend about the Cowboys supporting the Chiefs' overtime proposal. I can never get really worked up about overtime, but that is clearly something that some owners are interested in. What do you think is going to happen at this upcoming owners' get-together in the spring here with the Cowboys, Chiefs, the overtime proposal? Why don't you tell us what it is?
I think that they're eventually going to approve it. And, A, this is the Chiefs. Obviously, everybody watched the AFC title game. The Chiefs did not get possession in overtime, and apparently that really bothered them. Forget the fact that they couldn't stop Tom Brady at all during the Patriots' one offensive possession, and that the Patriots converted multiple third downs on the drive, and that the Chiefs' defense tanked. The Chiefs do not care about that. The Chiefs want to know why the Chiefs' offense did not get the ball. So in March, they proposed a new overtime rule saying, hey, both teams need to get a possession in overtime, even if the first team scores a touchdown. They talked about that at the spring meeting in March, and the owners basically said, I don't know if we're ready to do this. Let's table it. Let's talk about it in May. And here's what I've noticed over the past 6 years since I've been covering the NFL for CBS is that if the owners table something and then put it back on the table in May, it generally passes. We saw that with the extra point. That was a huge change. They weren't ready to do it in March. They tabled it for a little. They approved it in May on a one-year trial basis, and then now it's permanent now. So I do think that this is going to get approved, especially Wilson, you just mentioned the Cowboys being basically supporting this. And, you know, once you have Jerry Jones' support, he's a powerful guy in that owner's room. And, you know, I don't know what you guys think, but I feel like this is going to go through for at least this year.
I think
like
it goes.
I don't care about it, but it, like, it doesn't make sense. Like, I'm going to sound like Pete Prisco because I actually agree with him. His stance is your defense needs to be better if you can't win the coin toss. Sean, you're a millennial just complaining about.
Yeah, I completely disagree with that. And I understand that point, and I think it was probably much more relevant back when you and Prisco were young. But I think the roles are so geared towards helping offenses that we're in an era of peak offensive football. If you look at like every statistic of throwing stats, right? Like nowadays, like an 85 passer rating is not good, but like 10 years ago, that was like a fine passer rating. And so I think the rules are so geared to helping offenses that it's no longer entirely fair to defenses. So I would just always hate to be stuck as the team that has to get a stop before they can get the ball.
Yeah, but it's a field goal, not a touchdown. That's sort of the middle ground.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a fan. Before this whole Chiefs thing, I always liked the college overtime. Now, I don't think that fully works in the NFL because I think you can't start at the 25 because kickers are too good in the NFL and it would just keep going on forever because no one would miss. But I do like the idea of, like, matching score for score, starting with the ball at a certain yard line.
Like, so you like the XFL idea of two-point conversion? You do a two-point conversion, but at the same time. So both offenses, basically there's 44 players on the field, one on one goal line, the other on the other goal line, and you score, you're done.
You know what else?
If both teams block the kicks and they return it the other way.
Chaos. It's like the band is on the field, except like too many players. Speaking of the XFL, when the XFL was around the first time, I remember they, instead of having the coin toss, they would have two players race for the ball, because I remember the first time they did it, someone like broke his collarbone and was out for the year. I would be much more inclined to like say keep the rules the same if it wasn't just a coin toss and something that was luck-based, if there was some skill-based competition to see who got the ball first. I don't know if it's a 40-yard dash, maybe some arm wrestling with the coaches or something, a thumb war. I think Breach is trying to.
Well, yeah, no, I was saying, Sean, I'm glad you brought that up because that's actually – so the Chiefs – part of the Chiefs' proposal is that they want to dump the coin toss for overtime, but not really, because they want the – whoever wins the coin toss to start the game will also get to make the decision in overtime. That's part of the Chiefs' proposal. But I think that is also dumb because you're still going by a coin toss. You're going by a completely chance-based scenario to decide a skill-based game. So here is my proposal – because you mentioned the XFL, they would race to see who got the ball first, so it did take some skill. My proposal to start overtime, this is how you would start overtime, is that the visiting team picks a field goal distance, so say 55 yards, and then the other coach gets to decide if his kicker is going to try it or the other team's going to try it. So there's only one kick, and then if your kicker makes it, you get to decide what you want to do.
Yeah, so it's an auction. And in fact, Michael David Smith came up with that probably 7 or 8 years ago.
That's to take possession of the ball.
Unfortunately.
So it's not the same thing.
That's right, yeah.
So
it's a variation of that. I like it. I'm actually on board with that. Before you go on, Sean, I want to point out that you guys are dismissing the fact that a coin toss is chance. Bill Belichick would disagree. And some idiot wrote a story about how they never accept a coin toss.
You are a coin toss truther. This isn't obviously up for vote, so this won't happen this year, but the way I personally would fix overtime, I think for the regular season, I think you pretty much keep it the same because I think with player safety, you don't want guys playing that much longer. To be frank, in the regular season, I would kill overtime and just have more ties. I just don't think you should be playing after that 60 minutes, especially with teams on short weeks. My playoff proposal is I think you should just play another full quarter or a 10-minute quarter. And I don't think football has ever been a game about who scores
Welcome
first.
Welcome to soccer.
It's about who is winning at the end of a set amount of time. So what I would do, and this also eliminates the coin toss, is I would just keep playing. So if it's tied at the end of overtime and a team has the ball on the 40-yard line with 3rd and 6, I think you just, you know, switch sides of the field and then they have 3rd and 6 with 15 minutes left to go in overtime.
I've never seen such a passionate Breach about sports as when he brought up that idea and it reminded you of soccer.
Yeah, he's trying to turn this into a soccer podcast. So what happens if you're in overtime number 8 during the NFC title game, Sean? How do you shut that down?
It's just not going to go that long.
Well, no, because soccer eventually has a cutoff. They go to shootouts. What would football's cutoff be?
You do one, and then you do a field goal contest.
Well, obviously, I'll vote for that.
I actually would be very down to see a field goal kicking contest. And you know what I mean? Like, make kickers more important again. Like, these guys should be valued.
Well, that's sort of what John's getting at with the auction. I will say this. Coaches are so risk-averse. No one's ever going to say 55 yards, which you sort of threw out there. I'm guessing that was just sort of off the top of your head. I would guess, like, 42 yards would be the average starting point.
Well, no. You only get – there's no auction. You pick one number. So the visiting team, if he says 42, the home team's going to say, yeah, our kicker is going to try that 42-yard because he's not going to miss. But you say, like, 52 – now the home team might want to, you know, if it's Matt Nagy, he's not sending his kicker out to try 52 yard to determine whether or not he gets possession because he knows he's going to miss.
I feel like 52 yarder, 95% of coaches say no. I feel like 42.
You have to have like Justin Tucker or someone like that.
Right. Who's next after Justin Tucker on that list for 52 as the answer to?
Man, that's rough.
Exactly.
I mean,
kickers don't have
right. There's a couple you would consider.
Way.
You can consider like Gold. I mean, he's made 95% of his kicks the last 3 years.
He's bald, though. Automatic disqualification. Who else?
I don't even think you would do Vinatieri. Like, despite Vinatieri's, like, legendary status, like, if you look at his field goal percentage, Harrison Butker has been incredible the last 2 years. I think he's at, like, 95% as well or something.
And,
like that.
And the record holder for longest kick is Prater with the Lions.
But he's not, like, he's got a leg.
He's not a lock, right.
Yeah, he's kind of erratic at times.
All right, since Brenton's out of here, we'll continue the special teams conversation. Let's talk about Sean's Bears. They brought in 455 kickers to try to replace Cody Parkey the other day. Cody Parkey! I feel like that's how you have to always say his name. They brought in 8 guys, Sean. Matt Nagy did. They kicked from the 43, which is 1 yard higher than what I just suggested, because that's where your guy honked a field goal in the playoffs last year. And out of those 8, do you know the story, Sean?
Yeah, I actually ended up – I was the one that wrote it on Friday.
Okay, so 8 kickers were at the tryout for 43-yarders. How many made?
So it was that rookie minicamp, and so, like, you can bring in a lot of guys that aren't technically, like, signed to the team and have these big competitions. And so they had all 8 kickers attempt one field goal from 43 yards out, and Matt Nagy was very clear, they know why we are kicking from this exact spot. Kickers went 2 of 8 combined on those field
You're
goals.
You're horrible at math. Do you know what 2 of 8 works out to percentage-wise?
Yes. It's 1/4, which is 25%.
You got that look in your eyes. It was priceless, by the way. All right,
well, when you said – when you brought up math, I was like, uh-oh. But then you gave me an easy one. And it's just – to me, it's like, look, 1 year after you give Cody Parkey this big contract and you had to cut him, the solution isn't to bring in a bunch of no-name guys and hope one of them magically turns into your solution, because it's one thing to make it at practice, which these guys can't even do. It's an entirely different thing, you know, when they actually go to they're not even kicking at Soldier Field. And so I don't think any of these guys are the solution. I think if this incident or this competition has proven anything, it's that they really need to go and trade for Robbie Gould. And I know the 49ers.
Robbie Gould, he's gone. He's not coming back.
Gould requested a trade, and he pretty much said, I want to go to Chicago because that's where his family is. The 49ers obviously have said they don't want to trade him. I can't imagine if you offer a decent pick for a kicker.
That's what I was going to say, Sean. So if the Bears were to say, we'll give you a third round pick, the 49ers would do it in a second.
Yes.
But would the Bears be that crazy?
Yes. This is a general manager who had like 4 picks in this draft, and he traded up for a running back in the third round. Like, Ryan Pace has over and over again with the Trubisky trade, and every year he's trading up with the Patriots, a team that is always smart and, you know, always getting more draft ammunition. Pace is always trading up, which shows that he doesn't really value this idea of you need to have as many picks as possible to give yourself the best chance of drafting good players. If he likes a guy, he has shown the willingness to just give up ammunition for it. And I think if you look at this Bears team and you say they're a playoff team, and what's their one weakness? It's the kicking game and how their season ended last year. I would absolutely consider giving it up. That said, there are a couple guys in free agency, one in particular, Matt Bryant, I think, would just be a better, cheaper, you know, replacement. He might not be as good as Gould. He's been indoors for the last however many years.
And he's 42, and that's a little tough to ask somebody that old to kick outdoors.
Right. No, I think that's a completely valid point. I think you'd have to go look at his stats in these outdoor games. He's been very good, you know, with the Falcons, but most with half his games indoors.
But he's like Janikowski, where he's so old, he literally injured himself kicking a football.
It's not like Gould is young either. But I just think it makes too much sense. He's asking for a trade. I know the 49ers are saying they won't do it, but the 49ers have to say that to maintain as much leverage, and I think they would be crazy to turn down if you offer like a fourth round pick.
Sean, how far away from you, from the Bears calling you for a kicking tryout?
Pretty close.
The funny, I've actually, in my past, I've been able to make in the 40 to 45 range without a line there.
That's not funny.
They want me. I think I would probably choke. I was terrible at penalty kicks in soccer. I think I'd probably choke on field goals too.
By the way, one of the guys that didn't get cut in that eight man competition, and I hope this guy makes the team. His name's literally Chris Blewett. So here's the Chris Blewett making the team. He beat out so far six other guys.
And let me throw out one more kicking nugget. Another guy that's still on the roster that survived this tryout is Casey Bednarski. He's actually one of these rookie kickers that I had heard of before all of this hell broke loose at Bears rookie camp with, as Ryan said, 4,000 kickers. So Bednarski was a pizza guy after high school. He's like just making pizzas. You know the Papa John's commercials, just flipping pizzas up in the air? That's what he was doing because he couldn't find any place to play. I think he went to community college or a JUCO for 2 years because that's all he could get. And then some D2 school called him. He went to this D2 school, hit a 63-yard field goal back in September, tore it up, had great stats. So, you know, this guy 4 years ago was making pizzas. Now he's trying out for the Bears. I feel like that's the kind of personality you're going to need to handle Chicago is like, dude, I was a pizza guy 4 years ago. I don't care if I don't make the team, but I'm going to make the team. So I think of the three guys left on the roster, Blewett, Bednarski, and they kept one other Elliott Fry. I'm going to make Bednarski the odds-on favorite of those three, but as Sean said, probably going out and signing a free agent would be the best move.
The one last note on this. Maybe the only good thing this like that will come of the situation is that Matt Nagy will become the first coach to stop kicking extra points and just go for two all the time. And maybe this is what's going to move football completely forward into like the modern 21st analytics driven century. Maybe it's just going to be because the Bears just have no faith in their kicker making anything beyond 20 yards.
Well, one more thing about Bednarski, sorry, Ryan, is that he went to college in Minnesota, so he's used to kicking in that climate, which is a huge plus when you're talking about place kicking.
You knowing this much about this random kicker that me and Wilson have not heard of before is just the most breached thing ever. This is very on brand.
Yeah, it very much is. Also, I love that Sean thinks that Nagy's going to be at the cutting edge of analytics with a quarterback who's basically the Bednarski of quarterbacks. All right, we'll break down the best remaining free agents and potential landing spots. But first, a quick reminder, CBS Sports is your live streaming home for the PGA Championship on Saturday and Sunday next week as Tiger looks to make it back-to-back major wins. It's a must-watch weekend from Bethpage Black. By the way, can either of you name the last time Tiger Woods had back-to-back major champion wins?
I would throw out 2005 off the top of my head. I have no idea if that's right.
Are you a golf guy, Sean?
I'm not a golf guy, but I'm sure Breach is right around the range because I'm
Breach
aware.
Is close. It's 2006. I was a huge golf guy until Tiger ran into a tree, and now I'm.
Yeah, that's not all he did.
That was the beginning of the end, but he's back.
So Brinson doesn't run into a tree on his vacation.
Yeah, let's hope Mickey Mouse takes Brinson out and it's on video. All right, the best remaining free agents, our guy Cody Benjamin wrote this up on Monday. One of the things you'll notice is that a lot of these guys are old, 30 and north. Let's see, is there anyone under the age of 30? I think Ziggy Ansah's 29, but he's battled injuries. He's still out there as an edge rusher. I suspect he'll come relatively cheap just because it's post-draft. Most rosters are set, and there's certainly a need for edge rushers, but he ain't going to get what he probably wanted 2 months ago. Cody has Ziggy going to the Bills, which I think makes some sense. I don't know if you guys have that in front of you, but
I've got it.
Anything else they got there? What about Eric Berry to the Browns, John? What does that do for you? Does that wet your whistle?
Well, I'll tell you, Wilson, I know you read my story last week of the five best landing spots for Eric Berry, and the Browns were absolutely on that list. I mean, you look at them, they traded away Jabril Pepper. So obviously we can agree they won the Odell Beckham trade, but they did leave themselves a slight hole at safety that needs to be filled. And I feel like Berry is, if you're talking about adding a free agent, that is the best option. Now, we have seen that the Browns have drafted a safety. They signed a free agent safety, I think Morgan Burnett, and they traded for a former Chief safety who is not Eric Berry. I can't remember.
Eric Murray.
Yeah, yeah. So that trade was when Emmanuel Ogbah got sent to Kansas City. That's who the Browns got back. So they've added a bunch of safeties this offseason, but I just don't think that any of them are necessarily the answer. So it feels like not a high-risk move. I think the one big question is, what kind of money is Eric Berry demanding? I mean, you can't be demanding too much when you've only played three games in the past two seasons, but also he's Eric Berry, so maybe he is trying to get in the $10 million range. I envision this ending up something like Richard Sherman did with the 49ers, because he was coming off an Achilles injury after the 2017 season. Then we saw him negotiate his own contract last year, which was very incentive-laden. I think that's what Berry needs to do. That's what the Browns need to talk him into doing. And just to throw out the other four spots beside the Browns, the Redskins, the 49ers, the Colts, and the Cowboys were the other fits.
John, let me ask you, though, if you're Eric Berry's agent and whoever you're talking to, you say, hey, Earl Thomas, who can't stay healthy, signed a four-year, $55 million deal with the Ravens.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm Eric Berry's agent, that is absolutely what I have tattooed on my forehead walking into the room so that everybody knows where I'm coming from in negotiations. But then if I'm the general manager for the other team, I'm just like, here's a list of games that your client has played in for the last two seasons. So Earl Thomas, I feel like, is on the field a little bit more, obviously dealt with that broken leg. But, man, I just don't know how Eric Berry can expect to get more than, say, $6 million a season, which I think is affordable for any of the teams we just mentioned.
And yeah. Last year, Honey Badger only signed 1 year, $7 million for the Texans, and he was mostly healthy.
Yeah, I feel like Barry's going to get that one-year incentive-laden deal to, you know, prove that he can stay healthy. But I feel like I think Browns are the best spot, and they were also connected to – we thought they might sign Earl Thomas briefly in free agency. So they've been connected to safeties for a while. If you look at, you know, best teams with the most cap space, the Browns are fifth there with $33 million. So it feels like if someone's going to overpay for that for a safety, they could afford to do it. And that doesn't mean they want to do it. That doesn't mean they want to commit a lot of money to Berry, have him get hurt, and then have to cut him and eat a bunch of dead money. But the Browns can afford to slightly overpay for him and outbid any team that's interested.
So, Sean, you hate the Packers because they regularly beat the crap out of your favorite team. Cody has Michael Crabtree perhaps going to as a good landing spot for Green Bay. I think that makes sense because he's basically a modified tight end at this point. He ain't beating anybody down the field. He can control the middle of the field and all that other stuff. How do you like Crabtree with Aaron Rodgers?
As a Bears fan, I'm just shaking in my boots here thinking about Crabtree going to – no, I think it's fine. Like, he's a possession receiver. He's always kind of been a possession receiver. It probably makes sense. I mean, who –
You're not worried?
No, I'm not, but I'm not worried about it.
Are you worried about the Packers overall? They've had a pretty good offseason. Actually, a really good offseason.
I think it depends a lot on LaFleur, which I just don't think we can know, like, how he and Rodgers are going to mesh together. And a lot of it depends on the defense.
A million times better, though.
A lot of it depends on the defense because they've
just told you the defense will be a million times better.
Well, we thought that last year because they've been drafting defensive backs like crazy. They went even more heavy on defense this offseason. They made that much more the priority than the offense. You still got to – there's a difference between adding a bunch of talent on paper, though, and actually having that translate to success.
I want to throw one in on Crabtree real quick.
Oh, yeah.
One possible team for Crabtree. I love that Ryan mentioned he's basically a modified tight end at this point because you know who loves to throw to tight ends and you know who used to throw the ball to Crabtree? Joe Flacco.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the Patriots. I was like, wait a second, Tom.
Yeah,
Brady.
No. I was Michael nodding, thinking it was Patriots, and then he said who used to throw the ball to Flacco. I was like –
nice curveball, John.
Brady –
there's your curveball. I was going to go Broncos, and then if the Patriots were interested, obviously they make sense too. They'd be choice 1A, but I think like the Broncos would make sense, and obviously the Patriots, like you guys just said.
Yeah, so yeah, the Broncos got Noah Fant, who is completely – he actually is probably much faster than Michael Crabtree at this point. But, yeah, Joe Flacco loves tight ends probably more than Tom Brady. It actually looks like the Patriots are going away from tight ends this year, which is like the most Belichick thing ever. Let's see what else we have on this list. Jay Ajayi to the Falcons makes some sense. They lost who'd they lose? They lost Tevin Coleman. They still have Devonta Freeman and Ito Smith, but they need some depth there.
I like the I like the Sue to the Colts. Like that to me screams like why hasn't this happened? Because
yeah, it's actually sort of funny because Jerry Tillery, who was drafted by the Chargers, a lot of people liked him going to the Colts to play in that exact role, and we've seen. If we've learned anything, it's that Ndamukong Suh can be motivated if he's winning. And I feel like they have a good chance to win there as opposed to when he was in Miami and literally just mailing it in every day.
Yeah. You know, it's crazy. It doesn't feel like the Colts have a lot of holes, but I feel like you could almost make an argument for any player we've just talked about going to Indy. They've got so much salary cap space. Obviously, Sue would be good. Ziggy Ansah would be decent. Jay Ajayi, you know, maybe he's not – they have Marlon Mack, so he doesn't have to go in and play every down. He could be a decent fit. You could even make an argument for Eric Berry. The Colts clearly want to have someone at safety who is not quite in gathers because they drafted two safeties, and maybe Berry comes in for a year, mentors those two rookies they just drafted. So, really, the Colts could be a strong argument for any of these guys on the list, but I definitely like the Saw thing you guys – Sue's just thing you guys just said.
Well, look, the Colts – gave Devin Funchess like what, $14 million or something? Like, if they're willing to give Devin Funchess $14 million, go give Sue a 1 year deal that pays him what he wants to get paid for 1 year. It's a 1 year commitment. He might not, like, as Ryan was saying, we didn't really notice him on the Rams until the playoffs started, really, but he was dominant in the playoffs. And the Colts seem like a team that's going to be playing meaningful games in December and January. Why wouldn't you want to? That seems like a perfect team in win now mode with a lot of cap space. Clearly willing to throw overpay some players on 1 year deals. Why not go do that?
I feel like the Colts could be a sneaky Super Bowl favorite for the AFC.
Don't tell Brinson, he'll steal it and I'll be a Super Bowl pick.
Back on the Chargers. Brinson is back on the Chargers boat.
And so he listens to this podcast.
It's basically the Patriots, the Chiefs, and the Chargers. I don't think anyone in the AFC North is better than the Colts right now, do you?
No.
No.
I'd say top three.
It's also Sace DeMaio, so a lot can change. And I want to make Sace DeMaio a big thing, by the way. So.
I don't know how I feel.
Except that the people listening to this, it is Siete DeMaio.
Make that a big thing, too. All right, so those are some of the free agents to watch out for that could sign in the coming weeks and maybe even months. I mean, there's really no hurry at this point because the rosters are pretty much set. There's a couple of big names. I mentioned Barry. Cody has Derek Morgan, the edge rusher from the Titans, maybe going to the Steelers. That actually makes some sense. They didn't draft one. They don't have much depth behind Bud Dupree and TJ Watt. But, some things to look out for. Quickly, before we move on, I wanted to mention, John, do you know Jason Myers?
The rookie kicker that used to play for the Jets, and then they let him go, even though he made the Pro Bowl? No, I've never heard of him.
A simple yes would have worked for each.
That was my Ace Ventura answer.
That's your Sean talking about Game of Thrones answer. Well, I was writing about the Seahawks on Monday about a couple things they could do to actually go from playoff team to Super Bowl team. And I was like, well, they need to upgrade the kicking position because Janikowski retired. And they signed Jason Myers. And my question was, why in God's name would the Jets let Jason Myers go? We just talked about the Bears. They – learned, and the Steelers for that matter, they learned very quickly how important it is to have a kicker. So they signed Jason Myers, and you can actually talk to this, John, because kickers are fluky and flaky. So they signed, the Seahawks did, Jason Myers, to a 4-year, $15 million deal, whereas your Jets brought back your guy Chandler Cannizzaro for a 1-year deal for $2.3 million. I mean, is that money enough to make you not want to sign a guy who's really, really good?
Well, it's funny that you did that because, and I'm going to go back to the Seahawks real quick, but I'm also writing – we're doing a thing, three moves, and we're going to talk about the podcast later this week, so we won't go very much into it now, but I am writing one up for the Vikings, three things they could still do this offseason to make them have a better chance of winning the Super Bowl, and one of my things is also kicker.
I'm doing the same thing for the Falcons, by the way, that I'm about to write today.
Well, I mean, a kicker's a huge deal, and here's the thing is that, and back in March, I did write where free agent kickers might land and list the best ones, and even though Jason Myers was coming off a Pro Bowl season, you know, he wasn't number one on my best kickers available list, and here's his problem, and here's why the Jets let him go, and here's why it's risky that the Seahawks got him. It is because he is not good at kicking extra points. You look at he was okay with the Jets last season. I think he hit 90%, which isn't great. That's not great. He was 30 of 33 from extra points with the Jets.
That's actually really good.
No, for extra points, that's not good.
Huh.
It's really bad. 90% is bad.
Chris Boswell would like a word.
The first year, the extra point rule change in 2015, Myers was playing for the Jags. He hit 82% of his extra points. That is not good. Let me just tell you, to put this all in perspective, that the top 15 kickers in the NFL last season were all 95% or above on extra points. So the top half of the NFL, you should be 95% or better. Jason Myers has never gone above 90%, and he's bottomed out at 82%. So he has been literally, I think, among active kickers who have played since 2015, he has the lowest extra point percentage. And if you can't, like, faithfully send out your kicker knowing to kick an extra point and know he's going to make it, that's a huge issue. And I think that is part of the reason why the Jets let him go.
That's actually a fantastic.
And what did the Seahawks sign him to?
Let me look real quick. Four years.
It was a big deal, right?
4 years, 15.5 with $4 million signing bonus, $7 million guaranteed.
See, I like that less than I like the Jets letting him walk, because I mean, this is just me being a Bears fan, but I don't like this idea of throwing money at a kicker because he had a good year and committing multiple years to him. Like, the Bears just did that with Cody Parkey, and they thought, oh, they solved the kicking problem, and then they had to eat a bunch of money.
I mean, imagine what happens if Myers hits a 60-yard field goal to tie a game in Seattle and then blows it in overtime in the playoffs because he misses an extra point. Like, total meltdown. You got to let him go after 1 year, and he walks away with $7 million, and he doesn't care because he 1 year, $7 million is amazing. So it's risky. Giving a kicker with those kind of PAT stats is highly risky, but, hey, Seahawks haven't been able to figure this thing out. They let Hoshka go a few years ago. Seattle's not an easy place to kick. The weather there is crazy. So it was a risky move to sign anyone, especially to that kind of contract.
Just to put a cap on this kicking conversation, which, by the way, I love that we get Brinson off the podcast and then suddenly this just turns into 30 minutes of kicker talk with Breach. But here's the crazy thing. Bring it full circle.
This is my favorite podcast ever.
Since the Bears cut Robbie Gould 3 years ago, Robbie Gould has made 96.5% of his field goals in that span. What would you guess the Bears kickers have combined to make?
80%.
I was going to say under 80. 75.
76.
Nice. Well, Ryan Pace is not doing a great job with the special teams. I think that's the takeaway.
Yeah, and also that
the NFL team wants to hire me as a kicking consultant, I'm available.
Wow. On the podcast, you are just basically telling CBS I'm willing to quit.
No, I can work both jobs, and I'll also still podcast.
Interest, Reach, you can't cover the NFL and work for an NFL team.
People at CBS that do more than one job, Sean. Try it.
I'm a NFL writer, B, Game of Thrones scholar for CBS.
No days off, Sean. No days off.
All right, speaking of Game of Thrones, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk about Game of Thrones. So if you don't want to hear the spoilers or hear Sean's stupid takes, now's the time to quit listening. But just so you know, we'll be back tomorrow. But tomorrow's episode will feature CBS Sports fantasy expert Dave Richard and my guy, former Steelers cornerback and CBS Sports HQ analyst Brian McFadden, BMAC. And then on, what will that be, Wednesday, I think, or Thursday, Pete Prisco and Brady Quinn will be on Thursday's show, and they'll talk some more post-draft power rankings. And then the three of us will be back for the final show on Friday. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, dun-da-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun.
Oh, my God, that's bad.
The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at newbalance.com.
The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The all-new Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third-row seating, available dual wireless charging pads ensure you can take on any adventure. Available H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on the dirt trails and kick up some mud. Standard third-row seating so your whole family can experience the thrill together. Available dual wireless charging pads so no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead phone. Whether you're tailgating out in the dirt lot, Carter Finley, shout out Carter Finley, or whether you're whitewater rafting, taking the entire family on an adventurous trip, maybe you're out camping at Mount Rogers. I used to go as a kid. Wish my parents had a Hyundai Santa Fe. The Hyundai Santa Fe is perfect for your family outing. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
Oh, God. All right, I'm back. I'm back by myself. Everyone got off the podcast after that.
Brinson does the Game of Thrones song a lot better than you.
Does he really?
For as much crap as we like to give Brinson, that rendition of...
Yeah, that was an impromptu last minute.
I think you're watching a different show. I think this explains why you thought last night's episode was terrible.
All right, before you get started with your cold, hot takes, John, what were your thoughts about episode, what was that, four? Episode four, season one.
I was in the middle. I feel like I'm going to be the neutral guy here because I understand why Ryan didn't like it. I do not think, definitely do not think it was as fantastic as Sean thought. I think Sean has already fired off about 40 tweets about it being the most amazing episode in Game of Thrones history.
No, you're misreading.
It was nowhere near that. And the thing was, this whole season, it's like episode one, we were like, oh, well, they have to build this arc back. They have to tell us where everyone is and set everything up. And now, after last week's underwhelming battle of Winterfell, I just felt like I don't think the season's been bad. I think it's been underwhelming. However, I will say that last night's episode, Sunday's episode, episode four, definitely, it is starting to feel more interesting. Like, I love that we had this Cersei face off with Daenerys at the end. That was just fantastic to see that. And then have Tyrion go up, and I'm sure Sean will talk about this more, but for Tyrion to throw out that Cersei is pregnant, which, you know, Euron is up there like, wait a sec, how'd your midget brother know that you are pregnant when you haven't talked to him in like 4 years of Game of Thrones time? So, you know, and obviously,
you think Euron's really that smart?
I mean, he's been way more smarter than I think everyone's giving him credit for this whole series, right?
I think. He should, like, the beginning of the next episode should be him discussing this with Cersei, but the show has definitely, as much as I defend it, just glossed over certain things that it wouldn't surprise me if they just make it as Euron is just too dumb to figure it out. He should figure it out. Like, Cersei definitely looked concerned, right, in that scene. What Tyrion was saying. Despite what Breach said, I had a lot of problems with last night's episode. Number one, they cut away from Arya and Sansa learning the truth about Jon's parentage, which seems like a pretty important conversation that I'm willing to bet they filmed, and I'm guessing the way they looked at it, they thought it probably just didn't live up to expectations, the character reactions. I did not like, there's a big plot hole in terms of the big battle at the end, which is how does Dany riding up high above hundreds of feet in the air not see the ships coming? So there's certain aspects of the episode I didn't like, but Breach is right. This kind of for me felt like more like we're getting back to what the show did so well in the earlier seasons, which is a lot of political maneuvering, some back channeling, potential backstabbing, a lot of good Varys Tyrion talks, which we haven't had in a while. I thought that was really good. I thought the beginning 20 minutes of them just at the feast minus the Starbucks cup was very good. And look, we got Jamie Brienne, I thought, which is something that I never thought we would actually see in that form, actually happen. So I thought that was really good. And I enjoyed the ending. Like Breach, it seems like they did a really good job of setting the stage. And I think what they did a really good job of this episode was showing how Dany is kind of becoming more along the lines of the Mad Queen. That aspect of her is coming out because she feels so isolated and she is beginning to feel like an outsider. And she's just watching John and all these people look at John like a hero, and no one is really looking at her that way. And I think you can fully understand her turn, especially with Missandei at the end dying.
Are we sure Missandei's dead?
maybe the Night King comes back, maybe not.
Here's one of my thoughts. Why didn't Missandei just grab Cersei and try to throw her off, both of them off the edge of the top of the building there? She's right there.
Her hands were tied behind her back, weren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, that would have been difficult to pull off.
Yeah.
Do the old headbutt to the chest.
But, like, if you know you're going to die, why not just go try it? Is that what you're saying, Wilson?
Try it. Worst case is you miss, and that's the story. You sort of head, you know, pile drove yourself into the ground. A couple things. I don't know what Bronn was doing. I know he was sent there three episodes ago, but why would he suddenly hate Tyrion and Jaime when he's, you know, he actually taught Jaime how to fight again after he lost his hand? That didn't make any sense to me. There was no sort of motivation because you know that Jaime and or Tyrion would hook him up. So that was weird. Has Is it just me, or has everyone gotten incredibly stupider?
Everyone's always been, or John and Danny have always been kind of stupid.
Okay.
And if anything, I think this is like very on brand that they would manage to mess this up. But I will say this to your point. My biggest problem, we've talked about this on previous podcasts, my biggest problem with the show in the recent seasons is that they seem to be working backwards. So what they clearly wanted to happen at the beginning of the season was they wanted Danny's army to be weakened to set up a fair fight in episode 5 so that we go into it thinking Cersei could legitimately win, which means they're thinking we got to eliminate almost all the Dothraki, so let's have them charge into battle, even though that didn't make much sense. Let's have her lose another dragon, but the way they do it is so quick and it doesn't really seem fitting because they want to arrive at this point where it's an even fighting force.
I get that. That's fine. I think – I know I said this a month ago, like with Breaking Bad, with the final season, you're going to find reasons to hate it. I don't hate it. It's just – I feel like it's gotten sloppy, and I don't even care. Like the Starbucks cup I actually think is funny. I don't care about that at all. People are – I can't believe that they would say it's okay.
People are just like – it's like – it's a fun thing to make fun – like they should be made fun of for doing that. But where you start to lose me is people being like, this is emblematic of what's wrong with everything wrong with Game of Thrones. Like, guys, they made, like, if you read an incredible, like, book and there was, like, one horrible typo in it, would you suddenly be like, nah, this book's trash? Like, they made a bad mistake.
Did you guys see, did you see Prisco's tweet about Starbucks?
It was the best, what
did he say? It is the best tweet ever in the history of Twitter. And this is in regards to the Starbucks situation. Has anybody considered the Starbucks cup was left there for promotional purposes?
Was that a serious tweet?
He's not.
Is he joking or is he
on Twitter?
Well, I mean, the funniest part is that if you're writing a winners and losers from this game of from this episode, I mean, Starbucks would be number one because A, we're all still talking about it. It's like $7 billion of free advertising.
It could be like a 7-Eleven cup for all we know, but people just assume it's Starbucks. By the way, someone answered Pete and said it's Starkbucks. How do you like that, Sean? Starkbucks around the corner.
I think your reaction, Ryan, when you were texting me that this was a terrible episode, I feel like you probably don't feel as strongly as that based off what you were just saying. Like, you have some quibbles, which I do too, but I still think it's a good episode, and you seem to like the season. Like, I think a lot of us are in agreement that the season feels rushed. There's no denying that, but at this point, I'm willing to overlook some of the plot holes, and I'm willing to overlook some of the just the pacing, like Danny getting to Storm's End that quickly, the next scene, and then getting to King's Landing, the next scene. I'm willing to overlook all that because I think they've done a lot of good stuff, especially in, look, I said this on Twitter, I'm going to defend the show and overlook a lot of its shortcomings when the best written character this season has been my favorite character. Yeah. So it's just easier for me to forgive them for their other mishaps.
And here's two issues, and you guys both kind of touched on one of them, because I was saying that I didn't love it, just a couple things that I thought I didn't love. And one of them, Sean, you mentioned with the dragon. Daenerys, you have literally the only flying capabilities in all of the Seven Kingdoms. You have the best vantage point for a war. You should have a scout. You are the scout who's going out and checking stuff out.
Have Bran warg into some ravens ahead of time and scout out Storm's End and be like, oh yeah, you're on the clear. Like, go for it.
So there's no excuse for not seeing Euron's army. She deserved to lose the dragon. That's just, you need to be blasted. She should not be ruling anything. That alone means she should not be queen. Give it to Jon Snow. Wilson, you touched on this, which was Bronn showing up. Here's what I used to love about Game of Thrones was just everything so unexpected. You get all these deaths that you just did not see coming. And they had a chance to do that. I had totally forgot that Bronn was kind of headed to kill Tyrion and Jaime, and not necessarily I forgot it, just that I didn't think he would be there that quickly, so it wasn't anything that I thought was going to happen this episode. If he had shown up and just shot Jaime or just shot Tyrion, let one of them live, like, my mind would have been blown. That's all anyone would have been talking about, because no one would have seen that coming in this episode. Like, did you have any idea during that Jaime and Tyrion conversation that Bronn was just going to mosey in with the crossbow? And if he would have just shot Jaime in the head, and look, Tyrion, I love you. You pay me double, or I'm going to shoot one through your head and then left. You know, like, it would have been amazing, and that's all we would have been talking about.
But I agree, like, it would have been great because it would have subverted expectations. At the same time, I'm, like, when they all survived the battle, when Jaime survived the battle, I thought he might die. I was fine with it because I want to see a Cersei-Jaime showdown at the end. Like, that to me is more rewarding of a payoff, even if that means him having some plot armor in between them. in between that happens, because I just think that is going to be a much more rewarding experience. A couple of things real quickly that people on Twitter who have been mad about in the episode that I feel like is kind of understandable. People are mad that Jaime left Brienne and went back and is going back to Cersei.
Yeah, also stupid.
So this is the way I guess I should just, instead of saying people on Twitter.
Classic guy, Ryan just Coulson ditching hating. A girl after taking her virginity.
Jaime has only loved one woman his entire life before Brienne. He has only slept with one woman in his entire life before Brienne, and that's with Cersei. He has pushed a kid out of a window of a tower for Cersei. He has killed his own family to get back to Cersei. And so Cersei is pregnant with his child. There is about to be a big battle that she might die in. I think it's incredibly realistic that he would want to go and be there for that. And I think he might not know why he's going. I think he might think he thinks that he can be the one to talk Cersei out of this, but he also might get there. And I think he's going to decide that he's going to be the one to kill her. So yeah, I think it's completely natural for him to be like, this big battle's happening with the only person I've really loved my entire life, who is carrying my child. I'm not going to chill in the north and not be there for that. Like, I think it's completely natural that he would want to go be there for that.
All right, I'll give you that. What else?
And I'm not entirely convinced that Cersei's pregnant. I just want to throw that in there.
I want her to give birth to a dwarf from all her drinking. I think that would be very poetic with how she treats Tyrion. And then lastly, people seem to be mad that Brienne was kind of a sobbing mess at the end when Jaime left. And
he's mad like, about that.
Not in her. I saw some tweets about it, but this is – yes.
She was a powerful female character, Ryan, and they are now just ruining all of that. They're throwing away 7 seasons of character development. What? And making her a sobbing female who got dumped. That was the issue that people had on Twitter.
All right.
But this
Does that sum it up fairly, Sean?
Yes. It's just she's never been like this before, right? She's never been the emotional wreck crying ever before. But she's also never been vulnerable with another human in the show the way that she was with Jaime. And that was clearly like a big step for her that she was not comfortable taking. So imagine this close-off emotional person bearing your soul to someone and then having them leave for his sister. Like I think that would be traumatic. And I think there's a reason why it's the only time she's ever cried.
All right. My 10-second recap is that Bran is useless.
Short.
John, what's your 10-second recap?
My 10-second recap is we didn't bring up Arya and Gendry. Arya shooting him down. I still think that Arya's pregnant, and when she finds that out, she's going to end up with Gendry, and they're going to end up on the Iron Throne. Take that, Sean.
Have 30 seconds to preview.
Yeah, can we make one prediction each or something for the next episode?
You have 30 seconds. I'm talking to you like I'm talking to a 7-year-old. You have 30 seconds, so you have to go to bed. what's your preview for episode 5? Then you can make your prediction.
It's directed by the guy who does all the battles, including episode 3 of the season, so we're going to see the big conflict. However, I think the biggest conflict is going to be an internal one with Dany, and it's going to be if she fully descends into the Mad Queen, burn down King's Landing. I don't care how I take it. I'm just going to take it and be Queen of the Ashes and her turn potentially to a villain, or if she doesn't do that and manages to hold back her worst impulses that Tyrion and others have talked about. And the last thing is obviously, what do Tyrion and Varys do? But that seems like to me a finale question and not a battle question.
All right, what's your prediction? Or is that it?
My prediction is that, once again, we don't get all these big deaths that everyone thinks are coming, and I think a lot of those deaths are coming in the finale.
Jeez. All right, John.
Sansa lives. Arya and Gendry live. Everyone else dies.
Oh, and this next episode?
No. Over the next 2 episodes.
I was going to say, Sansa's in Winterfell, so I hope she lives.
Yeah. My prediction is that I think I'm going to predict that Jaime's going to die next episode. Just for leaving. And then
I wrote all those down.
Okay, good. Just for leaving Brienne of Tarth. Very rude. All right, that's it for the worst Game of Thrones recap outside of the Bill Simmons one. I couldn't help myself. I don't like that one. I like the Ringer review, but I don't like it when Bill Simmons does what we're doing here.
What did Bill Simmons do?
Well, he does basically what we do, a bunch of idiots talking about Game of Thrones that no one wants to listen to. The Ringer
you fired the shot in for like the 5 people who are still listening at this point.
Yeah. Well, I include ourselves in this sort of the everyday man recap that, you know, may not appeal to many people. Anyway, so that's it for the recap. Come back tomorrow, Dave Richard and B-Mac, and then the day after that, Pete Prisco, Brady Quinn, and we'll be back on Friday. See you later, nerds.